Rice actually started when I came out of that was a Chinese takeaway business, and it didn't work, and it was a dog. But when I was starting that, somebody saw it and they contacted me and they said, well, why not do Thai? And so out of that, you know, out of the bias for action, out of doing something rather than sitting at home, things kind of happened that led ultimately to Camille.
Hey, everybody, I'm Gary Fox, and this is episode 67 of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast. Today, I'm honored to be joined by one of the heavyweights of the Irish entrepreneurship scene, Mr. Brody Sweeney. You're going to hear Brody's full story, but you're going to learn three main things. Number one, why franchising might be your best bet if you're a first-time entrepreneur. Number two, how Brody bounced back after losing his O'Brien sandwich bar business in the late 2000s. And number three, why Brody is betting big on technology being the driver behind his Camille Thai business. Here we go with Mr. Brody Sweeney. Brody, welcome to the podcast.
Fantastic to be here, Gary. I've been hearing a lot about the podcast and I've listened to back to some of the shows. So great to be here. Privileged to be here, you might say.
Oh, well, it's a privilege to have you on. You're high up on the hit list of targets to get this summer. So it's brilliant. We're just kicking off season three. You'll be the second or third interview in season three. So it's brilliant to have you on. Let's get all the COVID stuff as much as we can out of the way early. What's been happening with you since March? Maybe bring us back to February, March, just when all this started happening for you.
Well, we've been going well as a business. So, we were up about 50% last year and on target for 50% this year. And then it kicked in, as you know, in early March, and we had a really wobbly couple of weeks when the lockdown started. We had a lot of trouble keeping the restaurants open because staff got really windy and didn't want to work. And then we dealt with that, and it went away really quickly. And so we haven't had any more staff issues. So we wobbly a couple of weeks, and then we were kind of holding our own during the lockdown. We were absolutely delighted with that because, you know, it's carnage out there in our world, in hospitality in particular. And then when the lockdown lifted, we got actually a pretty good bounce. So as we are here in August, you know, we're ahead of last year. Our business in London has got a really, really good lift. We're in a good place, and I say that guiltily because... Mm. I know I was involved with an organization called Save Our Restaurants at the start of it, at the pandemic, trying to help those who were worst affected. And so I'm absolutely acutely aware of how tough it is out there for lots and lots of businesses. So I say kind of guiltily that our business seems to be, at least to this point, kind of pandemic proof. We're focused on home delivery, as you know, and we're also located in suburbs. That's our business model. So we've got virtually nothing in the city centre, and we've got virtually nothing that's dependent on a dine-in business, which was closed down. So if you think about what's going on now, people are living in the suburbs, they're spending all their time in the suburbs, they're at home. Our business is fundamentally about selling people a hot evening meal at home. So we have just had all these things that have kind of fallen into place that really suit our business model. And I feel incredibly privileged and a bit guilty about that because I know, you know, if you're operating business in Temple Bar or you're in the business district in town, you're screwed. You're absolutely screwed. And these were colleagues of mine who had fantastic businesses in February and have businesses that aren't worth dick shit at the moment.
Was that intentional? Was that strategy intentional?
The inspiration for Camille was kind of Domino's Pizza, and we really liked what they were doing. So in the sense that they're the best in the world at doing hot food delivery, they have the best application. Wouldn't be crazy about the pizzas, but they really get the logistics of delivery. Mm. And so we basically, we're trying to do a Domino's and Thai food. That's basically the angle. And if you look at the pizza business, there's dozens of brands. So in Ireland, you got Four Star and Apache and Domino's and Pizza Hut. But there's nothing there's no brands in the home delivery of Thai food, or indeed in the home delivery of Asian food. There's none in the UK either. There's none in the States. There's none anywhere. So we think we've got this incredible opportunity as a business to build a Domino's type brand in Asian food, focused on home delivery. And that's what we've been doing for 10 years. So this kind of getting into home delivery, using apps to make purchases, most of our purchases are digitally made. Vast majority are made on digital platforms. That's not new to us. That's what we've been doing, we've been brought up doing. So this is why the pandemic has just suited us so well. People buying digitally, people being at home, in the suburbs, locked in their house. You know, at the start of the lockdown, it was difficult because people had bought a shitload of food in the supermarket, and then they were cooking it, and they were totally, it was a cooking buzz, but by Friday night, they're sick of mum's cooking, and they want a bit of a change, so here we are.
Yeah, we I think it was 10 weeks we cooked at home, and then for my wife's birthday, we were like, we're just getting a Camille. It's going to be our treat.
That's so great to hear. But a lot of people like that. You know, I mean, the amount of cooking that's been going on at home is really cool. It's pretty brilliant. The baked sourdough bread, the banana breads, people really experimenting, really using their cookbooks, probably for the first time in their lives, because most cookbooks sit on shelves, you know, adorning people's shelves. But they really got into cooking, and that's really good. We really support that. But there's also a point where you go, either I'm wrecked from cooking every day, or I'm sick of that. I'm sick of the home cooking. I need a little nice something that's prepared in a restaurant, and the way I can't do it at home.
So. You touched on something there. There's no brands doing what you do in the UK, America. Why is that? I guess that's the most obvious question.
Well, there's lots of brands doing Asian food. So if you think of the States, you think of the UK, you think of Wagamama. It's really good at it. Mm-hmm. And Yo Sushi is another one, kind of on the sushi side. But none of them have really focused on home delivery because they're, you know, where they're coming from is putting restaurants in high footfall locations, and that being a pretty good model up until now. So they didn't need to. So the chains we'd follow, like Leon or Pret-a-Manger in London, or Itsu, or Yo Sushi, or Carluccio's, or Pizza Express, they've all done really well with that strategy, and that's just been a terrible strategy for this environment. So I don't know why there's not. I mean, why there's not chains focusing on home delivery and Asian brands? Because, you know, really up until, you know, when we started out, like, the only people doing home delivery of food were pizza. And then since we started, Just Eat and Deliveroo started. So obviously that's opened up a whole plethora of new suppliers. But if you still think now on focusing on home delivery, actual restaurant chains, there's virtually none. They're all pizza. Mm-hmm. So you think of in Ireland, who could you name another one? So there's a few in the Thai space. In Ireland, relatively small. That's kind of it. You know, nobody else is focused on home delivery. So we just got that, I think, early. We were lucky. We embraced online. We thought, you know, conceptually where food is going to go was there's going to be a lot more home delivery. Partly to do with people being addicted to screens. So that was a really big thing coming along. So people are, as you know, we're all addicted to screens. We're spending ever more time on it. And so we're looking for more convenience. So where we might have been happy, as a general point, to spend half an hour cooking a meal before, now we prefer to do Facebook or Netflix or whatever the thing is and get it delivered. Mm. So our business model from the start was about delivering a hot meal to somebody at home on a screen. That was the business. And we just thought that was going to grow and grow and grow, and that people be buying more online. And we've been right about that. That's the way it's gone. And I guess others, you know, haven't kind of seen that opportunity yet. I think they're seeing it now because the only game in town in hospitality is home delivery and off-premises consumption. And so
what are your feelings on Just Eat and Deliveroo? You touched on them there. I suppose two-part question. A, did you ever envision something like that coming along and have such an impact? And B, what's your kind of feelings on them as a partner?
No, so we didn't. And, you know, politely, we just, I mean, they're, you know, we accept that they're there and we accept that people like purchasing through them. What I figured is that people are just addicted to scrolling. So whatever way you look at it, right? So you think of your Facebook, scroll, or your Netflix trying to find a movie, scroll, or now on your Deliveroo, you scroll, and then you get into a Camille menu and you scroll, and you're all addicted to scrolling. So people clearly like buying that way. So we have to accept that that's a reality. But the margins they take make, for most restaurant business, means you can't make any money out of it. So it's like crack cocaine. You know, you're addicted to it because it's bringing sales, but you can't make any money on them. Mm-hmm. So it's a really messed up business model, to be truthful, because as a generalization, restaurants can't make money through the aggregator platforms. And with the exception of Just Eat, like Deliveroo and Uber Eats in the UK, they don't make money either. So you've got this vast amount of venture capital from the States basically subsidizing every meal that's sold in Britain and in London. And that's a screwed up model too. So the restaurateurs aren't making money, they're not making money. You know, the economic cost of doing a delivery to your home is about £6. That's what it costs. Yeah. And we charge you as a business, I think, £2.99 to do it. 2.99. So the economic cost isn't being met by the consumer. Ultimately, that's what's going to happen, is consumers are going to end up paying £6 for delivery, whatever way that is. And then everybody will be able to kind of wash their face with it. But as it stands, it's like crack cocaine. You're addicted to it because it definitely brings extra sales to the brand, but you can't make any money out of it.
Brilliant answer. Bring me right back. You're probably the one of the most famous names in entrepreneurship in Ireland. Bring me right back. Brody Sweeney, pre-famous entrepreneur. What were you doing when you kind of left school? Were you always destined to be this? Was this like, I am going to be on my own business?
Yep, it was. I guess when I was really young, I was going to be rich and famous. That was kind of it. And my dad was kind of an entrepreneurial guy, and I've been entrepreneurial. Really, I started a business at 15 in school, cutting out trees, and then I had another business the next year called Southern House Minders, which was kind of employing friends of mine who were, say, carpenters or plumbers, and put them into houses. Like a cut of that, and then I got involved in my first franchise, which was Prontoprint, Mr. Printo, when I was kind of 20. And so I've always done my own thing. I'm basically unemployable. I've never had a job in the sense of having a working for somebody else. And I would say I am unemployable, because so when I went Boston O'Brien's 10 years ago, I mean, I was just 49 then. And one of the difficult things was I knew it was going to be very difficult for me to get a job. Notwithstanding, there was a depression, but just somebody who's 49 has never had a job, never worked for anybody. You're not terribly employable. So I did it from the start. And my first business, proper business, was this Prontoprint, which is a franchise from the UK. My dad bought the master franchise. I ran it. Never made any money. We had it for about 8 years. We opened 16 branches around Ireland, all with franchisees in them, but it was my kind of education bit. So franchises are a great way of learning. If you're young, I always recommend people, you know, franchise is a great way of getting started in business, because you have to touch on all the disciplines, you know, the marketing, the finance, the operations, the people, and you're doing it in a kind of a structured way where you've been taught how to do it. And that's a great foundation for any business after that. So that was my university of life, education in business. And then when the Prontoprint, towards the end of doing that, I knew I wanted to do my own thing, so I started O'Brien's, and then my dad died, and then I sold it. Then I sold O'Brien's, Prontoprint, back to the parent company in the UK. I got 15 grand for it, I remember, which was nothing, but it was enough to square it.
For the whole thing?
But this is a long time ago, because it was it wasn't really working. That's fundamentally, it wasn't, it couldn't make any money. It was too small, the Irish market for that.
I think that's interesting for people to hear, though, because I think a lot of people just associate you with massive brands and massive success. So 8 years you were working at that.
Well, at 8 years of that, never made any money. And then I started O'Brien's around 1988, I think. That's a really long time ago. You probably weren't even born then, were you?
Oh, I was, unfortunately. I was five.
So I started out in 1998, and I lost money for the first 6 years of that, 7 years of that. O'Brien's was great fun. I really loved it. So we had this really cool little Irish brand we developed, and then we built it up overseas. So I got to do a lot of travel and, you know, meet interesting people. And I was a bit like the Queen. I used to, you know, go somewhere like Taiwan to open an O'Brien's, and I get to smell a new paint because the place had just been spick and spanned up, ready for me to come and cut a ribbon on it. And that was very cool. Taiwan was really funny, in Taipei, because that was the first time we had a fair bit of business in that kind of part of Asia. So Singapore, Indonesia, Thailand, countries like that. And in Taipei, anyway, going in there to our brand new restaurant, and I see the customers in the front of the restaurant, and they're eating their sandwich with a knife and fork. Nice. Right, and I was going, like, that's so deadly, because it just reminded me, like, when we were young, going to a Chinese restaurant here, we give the chopsticks a lash.
Oh yeah,
you know, just to be authentic. And here's these guys in Taipei thinking, oh, they're Western, they must eat these with a knife and fork.
Bring me back to the start of O'Brien's, though. You said it didn't. You almost said it as an aside there. Oh, it didn't make money for the first 6 years. Yeah. How did you keep going? Like, how did you sustain and keep going and go, This is going to work.
Well, cash flows. Firstly, I'm always a kind of a long game kind of person. So I'd be accepting that I wasn't going to make money in the short term for a big prize down the road. And so I always thought it would make money, but it didn't make it at the beginning. And part of that is because I started with no money. And then you're constantly reinvesting to build your platform up. So I would happily take, you know, get six restaurants open in O'Brien's days rather than taking, you know, that money off the table as profit. I'd reinvest it. So partly it was no money. And also it's just mistakes. You can't get out of your own way. So the enthusiasm doesn't necessarily balance out the mistakes that you make. So there's a lot of errors, a lot of things you look back on and you go, you know, I could have done that much better or smarter or quicker or more efficiently. So you keep going because you've got cash flow. So when you've got cash flow, you can keep going way past when you're dead, actually. You've got money coming in every day. You know, it's a terrible thing about retail. You know, so many businesses are really dead, but because they've got cash coming in every day, they can keep going way past when somebody should have said, you know what, we would better to stop this now and go again because we're just getting ourselves into more trouble and it's not, you know, it's we can't turn it around. So eventually the mistakes, you couldn't avoid the mistakes, but you could maybe avoid making them twice. So when they started being, you know, those problems started replicating, I had some idea how to deal with them, and I did. And then the thing just took on a life of its own. It's very difficult starting a franchise, particularly because at the very beginning, nobody wants to be the guinea pig, you know, the first one or the first two or the first three. So when we were starting in this business, in Camille, starting the franchise side of it, we started marketing it probably 3 years before we sold the first franchise. And then it took another year to sell a second one, and now we're sold out. We can't sell franchises now. We've got nothing to sell. It is really hard getting them off the ground. And so I knew that from O'Brien. So when this was happening here, I'd be very pragmatic about it. You know, I think a lot of people think about starting something like a franchise and they go, oh, you know, we have an amazing offer, we just take off like a light. And I've never been in a business that took off like a light. I think they're very exceptional. They're very rare, those kinds of businesses. So ours was just slower. So anyway, so the Brian's thing just kicked off, and then
how did you know that you were going to have 100, 200, 300? Like a lot of people start
cafes. Target, you know, I was always that kind of almost childish ambition. So I set a target to have 1,000 O'Brien's.
Where does that come from? I'm just captivated by this.
No, just
where's
just
that big thinking come from?
Ridiculous fantasist, you know, that's. You think you can do it? This blind belief in your own abilities and how deadly you are and how brilliant as a business person. But I would say, you know, we did have an ambition to do 1,000 in O'Brien's, and we got to about 340. And so in one sense, that's a big failure. It's not even 35% of the target. But on the other hand, it was way better than if I'd gone like, oh, well, I'll open one and see if I get on, down to the second one, and see if I get on and do a third one. So we had this really big, hairy goal, and all the people who were working with me kind of bought into it, and it excited them, and it was deadly. And we definitely got way further than we would have got if we were, you know, we said we'll open one and see if we get on.
You ended up
and
in Taiwan.
So the same thing with this business. You know, we've got a big hairy goal here. And whether we hit it or not, it kind of doesn't really matter, but it's given us all something to go for and buy into and believe in.
How did you end up in Taiwan? You talked about you got 300 odd there. But
yeah,
how,
a great how do you story.
End up in like Taiwan?
There's a guy I met in Dublin. So we're marketing franchise in Ireland. And anyway, this guy came in to see us one day. His name was Hugh Hoiscock. It's a great name. And his son was in the College of Surgeons. Studying to be a doctor. And his son must have been raving about sandwiches and O'Brien, something like that. This guy's Hugh, lived in Singapore. And he came to see me, and he said, would you give me a master franchise in Singapore for O'Brien's? And I'm going, I don't even know where Singapore is. Yeah, no problem. And he said, and what about Taiwan and Indonesia? I said, I'll throw those in for you. No problem. You can
have those. So while you're here, we'll go for it.
While you're here, no problem. I have no idea where they were either. So this guy took on a master franchise, a really nice guy, became a good friend, and built a business in Singapore of his own, company-owned restaurants. And then he started kind of franchising in Thailand, Indonesia, Taiwan, China. and it's worked. You know, it's really interesting. In a lot of the Asian countries, they're really into Western brands. They had no idea where Ireland was and didn't ring at all. But it looked like Starbucks. It looked like Costa Coffee. Yeah. It looked like McDonald's. And so they bought into it, and they were happy out. And it was great fun. So, and then it was something I was really proud of, because you think when you get out to places like that, you know, Ireland's not very well known, and Irish brands aren't very well known either. We think Guinness is world famous, but it's kind of world famous in Ireland and England and Nigeria, and it's not really that world famous in many other places. What was big at the time, I remember the big Irish brands of the day were Roy Keane, Riverdance, and U2. Those are the big brands of the day. So we were going, and then some alcohol brands like Jameson. So we were going, say, opening up on a high street in Singapore. We didn't do alcohol. Or Malaysia. Malaysia is predominantly Muslim. And this was a kind of a really cool, acceptable brand and a nice showcase for Ireland, you know, because we were, you know, we were playing at Riverdance and we had nice Celtic imagery, and we were doing it. And it was the only visible Irish brand in a country like Malaysia. You didn't see any others. But that was great and all good fun, yeah.
How do you learn how to do something like that? Bring a brand to a country you've no experience in?
Well, it wouldn't happen except this guy walked in to see me. I wouldn't have gone somewhere like that. We were definitely ambitious to go into UK with O'Brien's, so that was very deliberate. But I had in my naive head kind of thought that UK was very like Ireland. You know, we look the same, we dress the same, we have the same types of shops. Actually, it's very different, as I've learned. But it looked the same.
I'll come back to that in a second.
but it looked the same. So, you know, getting started in London all those years ago. And it looked the same. And then we got a few. We weren't terribly successful, but I often find we open one ourselves, a company on restaurant, and it's really difficult. And then we put a franchisee and they make a great success. But that's what happened. And then it just kind of mushroomed. And we hit a tipping point where it just people wanted to buy them. Like they were on trend. And, you know, we started O'Brien's back in 1988. You wouldn't remember because you would have been tiny tot if you were at the time. But you know, sandwiches in Ireland came in three flavors, right? So they came in hang, and they came in cheese. And if you were really racy, you could have hang and cheese together, right? And they were wrapped in cling film, and they sat on top of the fridge, and they were made from sliced pans, and they had margarine on them for the butter. And that's how we started. So we started O'Brien's with going. That's really terrible. They're awful. So we got started with going to Johnson Mooney, and we got them to take every second, you know, they just kind of sawing up sliced pans, and then we got them to take every second blade out of the saw. And so we used double thick slices, and then we made them to order, and then we did hang, but we had five flavors of ham and five flavors of cheese, and you could get tuna and really racy stuff as well, like chicken, like actual fresh chicken.
Where did this come from? Where did the idea come from?
A friend of mine had opened a sandwich bar on Merrion Row, and not successfully, but it was really cool. It wasn't successful because it couldn't run it very well. The idea, that was the spark for it. And then I loved the franchising because I'd done the Prontoprint before that. And I loved the idea that you could build a brand up with somebody else's money. And I don't mean that in a bad sense, but I didn't have money. So franchisees were bringing the capital in to build the retail outlets. And when you got enough of them, you actually had built a national brand. You know, you built a proper brand name up. And with very little capital from my side.
Explain franchising to someone who's just beamed down off the moon.
Right. Well, it's a great way of doing business. I'm really positive on it. So basically, somebody comes up with an idea, like Camille, which is, so we come up with, our team come up with the idea of selling, you know, really good quality Thai food, like restaurant quality, but not doing it in a restaurant, doing it like a takeaway, so you can do it at home. And we put all the investment into that around how that works. So we figured out how to train people. You know, we figured out our menu. We figured out where to buy all the stuff. We figured out how to market it, how to market the restaurants, how to build them. We figured out all that stuff, right? And then, so we're doing it on our own account, and that's working fine. And so we're happy. And then you have a lot of people who want to do their own business, but maybe they're not that creative, or they're looking for something that's a little bit more secure than doing it on their own. So you could set up Gary's Thai Kitchen tomorrow if you wanted. And your risk will be much higher going it on your own than if you do it with a good franchise. And secondly, some people are really good operators, but they're not so good in the creative side. So they're actually good with people. They're good at building teams. They're good at running businesses efficiently, but not terribly creative. And so how franchise developed is somebody like us, you develop a way of doing business, a business system, which we're doing on our own account. And then we just go, well, we could grow this quicker and we could lessen the burden on us as managers, because you don't have to manage everything, if we let other people share the knowledge that we've already gained in this business section. That's essentially how it works. So we have fantastic entrepreneurial franchisees in our business who work really hard, are really smart, and they say, well, you know what, I'd happily pay you a small percentage of my sales to not have to worry about, you know, manning the social media at the weekend, to not have to think about where the business is going to be in 5 years, to not have to deal with the suppliers. And anyway, if I was dealing with suppliers of my own, I'm not going to get as a good deal as I am as part of your group. I'd happily do that rather than try and build a brand name for myself in Cork, rather than leveraging off our existing brand name, which is going to bring a certain amount of customers in to the door the day you open it up. And I'm likely to be able to sell that business with a brand over the door easier than selling Gary's Thai Kitchen, which maybe nobody's ever heard of. So you're going to get potentially good, better capital growth, and you'll earn more money than doing it on your own. So you take Domino's, just as an example. If you invest in a Domino's, and you can't, by the way, so because they don't have anything to sell, and anything they sell in Domino's is internally, they only sell to existing managers or existing franchisees. And in Ireland, we're pretty much like that here ourselves. We're only selling to people who are already steeped in the business. But if you invest 300 grand in Domino's, the day you open your door, that 300 grand is probably worth $1 million.
Wow.
Because it's got Domino's over the door. So the physical assets cost you 300 grand, is worth $1 million. And then you're going to earn a really decent return while you operate it. So if you invest your 300 grand, it's conceivable you might pay that money back in 2 years in a good franchise. Right. So that's really compelling. That's really, and it's much lower risk than doing Gary's Thai Kitchen. So that's why people are interested in it. You know, smart people are interested in franchising and why it works so well. So from our point of view, in Camille, we decided we wanted to own our own businesses in the centre of Dublin, which we do. And then I'd sooner go to London and Cork to expand the business, because there's more potential in London. Not for any bad reason, for Cork.
I was wondering there. I was like, we're going to just have the listenership.
Cork is 200,000 population and London's 8 million. Yeah. So I prefer to go where the potential is really high. So we open our own businesses in Dublin, and then we go to London to open our own business. But we franchise everything else. So Belfast, Limerick, Cork, Galway, Navan. We're really happy for franchise owners to take those businesses on, because we're focused on going to London now and building a business up there. That's what it's about. So that's why franchise is brilliant. So you in our business, you invest your 300 grand, I'd only get $1 million for it, but you might double it, which isn't bad. And you're going to earn, we can demonstrate that you can make a really acceptable return on that while you have it. And for a lot of people, they'd sooner do it with us and lower their risk than take the risk of doing it on their own. Because it's really hard to do it on your own. Much harder.
Yeah. Do you think many people know that? Do you think franchising doesn't seem like a very common route for people in Ireland at the minute still?
Yeah, it actually is. It's in all sorts of areas, from, you know, Home Instead, the home care franchise, it's really successful. And obviously that's in a really big growth area, to the fast food guys you'd know, like Supermax, Indigenous, and then KFC and McDonald's, and all the pizza guys, they're all franchised. And then you've your car rentals, like your Hertz and your Avis's. So a lot of brands that you might think are franchises, or you might associate with it, are doing this and doing this and doing this. A lot of it's kind of under the radar stuff. It's not necessarily terribly high profile. There's a brand called Tax Assist, which is an accounting one, really successful. There's Action Coach, another business support one, really successful, all operating in Ireland. So there's probably a lot more there than you think. But it suits a lot of people, and it works. A really good franchise works well for both parties. For the franchisee, the person taking the franchise, and ultimately you have to share the divvy out of the business. And if it becomes lopsided, so the franchisor is making all the loot, that doesn't work. Mm. The franchisee just have incentive to develop the business. And the same way, if franchisees are earning too much money, franchisors are incentivized to keep reinvesting and doing it. So it's a very careful balancing act. But my experience of it has been really good, really positive. And that's looking at it from both sides, because ultimately the success of franchises is the success of your franchisees. It's not, you know, if you take a franchise with us, Gary, we give you a toolkit to make your business successful. But if you don't use the tools, it's not successful.
So
a good franchisee takes that toolkit and uses it and doesn't question it too much. That's another thing, if you're getting involved with us, like, this is our way of doing business. You might think a bright pink shop front is the way to go, and we're going to say, we're sorry, Gary, you can't have a bright pink shop front. Or you might think chips are the way to go, which would be selling chips and Camille over my dead body. So you kind of have to accept that. But the quid pro quo for that is is that you're going to lower your risk, and you've got a business that's going to be easier to sell. And every business is hard to operate. The franchise business isn't any harder. But some of the big risky stuff you don't have to concern yourself with as much.
I get you. I want to just tie off the O'Brien story and then move on to Camille, because I'm really curious to understand the growth of Camille. When you touched on it there, you were 49, I think you said, when you finished with O'Brien's. Yeah. What was that period like? Because I think a lot of people see you as being very successful and where you are now, but what was that period like for you?
I've had much more failure and upset in my life than success. We basically put the business into examinership in 2009, and I had kind of semi-retired from the business in 2005, which is kind of 4 or 5 years before that. And because the business was going really well, and I wanted to do more interesting things. And when you work hard, and as lots of business people do, and they enjoy some success, it's really liberating, because it gives you the freedom to go and try stuff and do things. And
what did you want to do? I'm curious.
Well, I wrote a couple of books. One of them was a bestseller. It's kind of a bit of a joke now, because it's Head Start, Up and Stay Up in Business, and then I went bust a few years later. So my credibility was shot. So I did that. I stood for election for Fine Gael in the 2007 general election. I wanted to do that. And I started a charity working in Ethiopia. So I was having a really great time. I really enjoying the fruits of my hard work. And then around 2008, I could see the storm clouds gathering. So, country was starting to slow down. And so I went back into the business full time and tried to sort it out. And it didn't really work out. So we put the business into examination in 2009. It got taken over by the Abracababra guys, which really upset me at the time, because I'd spent kind of 20 years dissing them as a kind of cheap, nasty brand. And then they ended up buying the business. And I ended up with nothing. Like, I hadn't taken any money off the table. And I ended up in 2009 with, no job and no money and a huge Celtic Tiger mortgage. And that was a pretty bleak time. Not for very long, but it made me understand the word despair. And I never really thought about it before that, but the word despair means the absence of a compelling future.
That's dark. That is dark, Brody.
Yeah, it's very dark. And for a very short period, I didn't have a compelling future, and I found that very difficult. Personally, really, really hard. I couldn't figure out what to do, and I knew I needed to do something. I really couldn't figure out what to do. But it didn't last very long, and then I was like a cornered rat, So. I'm really screwed. I'm going to lose the house. I'm going to lose everything unless I do something. And that was genesis for getting Camille started.
Yeah. What changed? Because why I'm talking about this is that I think a lot of people are probably facing that decision now.
Yeah.
So that's kind of why I want to focus in on.
Yeah, but I think
what changed?
First of all, it's nothing noble or brave or I'm not that I'm different to anybody else. But I do think cornered rats. You think of the analogy of a cornered rat. It's like you come out fighting, to the death. Because that's the way. So I spent a short period sitting at home, in despair, unable to figure out what to do. I didn't know what to do, and that's horrible. And then I thought, I've got to get something started again. So what do I know about? I know a bit about franchising, a bit about food. So get started again. Cornered rat stuff. So you know, I've got to get some income going. Like, I've no income coming in, and I've no possibility of income coming in. And the shitty thing as an entrepreneur is when you go, well, you can't even get dole because you're self-employed. It's, so you just have to do something. And that was, like, I said, okay, I got to get something new started without even being sure what that's going to be. But I got to do something. So the bias for action is really important. You know, what I actually started when I came out of that was a Chinese takeaway business. I started a Chinese takeaway and it didn't work. And it was a dog. Like, it was shite. But when I was starting that, somebody saw it and they contacted me and they said, well, why not do Thai? And so out of that, you know, out of the bias for action, out of doing something rather than sitting at home, you know, things kind of happened that led ultimately to Camille. Even though it was like, you know, I did a business plan before starting this Chinese takeaway. I spent 6 months out of it. I would have been considered, up until I put the business in administration, like an expert, a veteran, like I really know what I'm doing here. And so I opened up a new business and it's completely crap, really terrible. And the story of that was that I'd opened it up. I was open about 6 weeks. It was going awfully. I'd been looking at Chinese food and thinking, you know, there's nobody put a brand on that. You know, I could do that. And so I set up a business called Yum Chow. I thought it was a really great name. Kind of bit of fun, vaguely oriental. And up in Dolphin's Barn, I couldn't get anyone to let me a restaurant after going busting O'Brien's because I'm persona non grata. We probably still don't do failure terribly well in Ireland. And so I opened this up. Didn't work. Was dissolved. Was open about 6 weeks. And this article was written about me in the Sunday Times, about half a page. It was a really cynical piece on the business section about, you know, how the mighty have fallen. Here's this, you know, so-called icon of the Celtic Tiger, now reduced to working behind the counter of a Chinese takeaway in Dolphin's Barn.
Wow.
Like, how low can you go? So I was a bit miserable. Like, firstly, the business isn't happening at all. I'm trying to keep my head under the radar because I've had quite a high profile. And so trying to keep my head under the radar and the business isn't working. And then they put the shitty article out and I'm going, the end of the world. And then as it happens, this guy reads the article and he obviously didn't read it as badly as I read it, but he read the article and he contacted me and he said, I've got a Thai brand that's working really well. It's going gangbusters. Why don't you come in with me? Because I don't know how to franchise it or brand it or any of that stuff. And we do a joint venture. And as it happened, I'd ripped off this guy's kitchen to build my kitchen. So it was identical to what he was doing. So we did a deal really quickly in the back of a fat packet. And 8 weeks after I opened my Chinese concept, I changed over to his concept. And it was literally change the menu and change the sign over the door. That's all we had to do.
Wow. 8 weeks. That's a very quick turnaround. How did you know it just wasn't going to work?
Well, because when you're, I was like, whatever, 5-6 weeks into my new business and you can fool yourself, you know, you can fool others. But I knew it was a dog.
You knew that. You knew the feeling.
It wasn't working, and it wasn't going to work. So we flipped over to him really quickly. It was like switching the lights on. It took off like a rocket.
Wow!
It was like, oh my god, I got my
same place, same location.
Same location, yeah. Just changed the menu from Chinese to Thai. Really interesting marketing case study. But we put the prices up by 40%, basically on whatever, you know, chicken curry in Chinese was whatever tenner. We charged 14 quid for it. And the business took off like a rocket. And so I'm ecstatic. I've got to get out of jail card. This guy I've met and I've just got a business with, like, I want to have his babies. I'm in love. You know, it's like, you know, I've gone from being completely screwed to now having some, you know, blue sky in front of me. And so ironically, as I'm wanting to have babies with him, he's having a complete change of heart. He's having what's known as buyer's remorse. He's going, this is crazy. I've given Brody Sweeney half my brand. It's all about my brand. It's opening his legs, taking off like a rocket. I need to get back out of this. I need to get him out. I need to get back out of this business, get back out of my relationship with him as quick as I can. And so we the grey hair does stand for something. So the way I structured the deal, we'd done very quickly in the back of the packet. I was able to walk away from it after 6 months. We changed from his name to Camille, more or less kept his menu.
What do you think sparked that change of heart in him?
You know, my mum always said to me, if you don't have somebody good to say about somebody, you shouldn't say it.
Fair enough. So you changed again. I think this is so interesting because I think too often we all look at something and go, oh, wow, Brody Sweeney Camille. Oh, it's so good. And they see the finished product. They don't look back 8, 9, 10 years and see Chinese name change, fallout, name change again. You know.
Yeah, see, actually, when I look back on the first year, I had changed the name over the door 3 times.
Your sign writer loved you. How are you, Brody?
And I'd gone into partnership with this guy, and I'd gone out of partnership with this guy, all in 12 months. And I ended up at the end of 12 months going, that kind of worked out okay.
You had a good solicitor and a good sign writer.
Well, it was just, I think the point is for people looking in is that, you know, most business plans don't survive first contact with the enemy, right? And if it was a good bit about me personally coming out of that, it was a recognition that I needed to change and change quickly. So I didn't have time. I couldn't have left that for 6 months because I'd have been actually bust. I'd actually have gone. So the recognition, you know, the honest look at it and saying it's not working, I need to change it. I'm not even sure what to change it to, but I do need to change it. And I think a lot of businesses start up with a plan. We invest so much time and energy in the plan. We get something to fund it, and then it doesn't work out. But we're so wedded to the plan.
You fall in love with it, yeah.
That horse. And I just encourage people just to stand back and have an honest look. It's not you need to pivot, or that's the modern word, but you need to change it, and then you need to change it, and you need to change it, and you need to change it, and you need to keep changing if you figure it out. You look at Michael Lee, Ryanair, Dennis O'Brien. That's what they did. You know, their first goes, like Ryanair was an absolute basket case at the start. It was going to fold. I'm involved in a little museum in Dublin, really cool place, by the way, a little museum on Stephen Street. They have a kind of funny little artifacts from Dublin. One of them is a Ryanair business class check-in card, boarding card. And that was an early iteration of Ryanair, the business class. And that wasn't working. So they changed it, and eventually they figure out a model that's working, and they then replicate that. Because Brian's exactly the same. His early attempts in business in telecoms, really tough, wasn't really working. Change it. That's what the good guys do. They change it, they figure it out. So they're not so wedded to the idea that they're blinkered completely. They can't see. And as you do, if it's, you know, most people starting new business, they've got a finite amount of time to get that right. But you can't wait, you know, too long. If it's not working, you need to change it.
Persistence beats resistance. Just keep going.
Yeah,
just
persistence. Keep, and keep the other going. Mantra we have now is that, you know, speed beats perfection. You know, get it out, give it a lash. Yeah. You know, I read a book called The Lean Startup. A few years ago, a guy called Eric Ries really made a big impression on me. But his was, they talk in that book about this concept of a minimum viable product. So where, you know, they're talking about, say, in the context of designing a computer game, there's a lovely story in it about, you know, a guy, you know, doing a computer game, and he needs to get this little soldier to go from A to B. And so he knew it would take 3 weeks to write the software to get it from A to B. So he just fucking morphed it there. He just ended up there, and he was really embarrassed about it, but the customers loved it. So the point is just get it out there and see what happens. And I think that's the same with a restaurant business. You know, we try loads of stuff all the time. We know most of it won't work. We just try it. See what happens. So get it out there. Forget about perfection. Get it out there as quick as you can, because the quicker you get it out, the quicker you're going to get feedback, and you're going to start learning about what's actually going on there. So wait for a year to get it just perfect, and then launch it and find out nobody wants to buy it. That's the old way. New way is spend a month, doesn't really work properly, but it works a little bit. Get it out there, start getting feedback, start iterating, and a year later you've got something that's actually working, rather than waiting for the year till it is perfect and then find out nobody wants to buy it.
Just experiment, like the podcast title.
Yeah.
A year into Camille, what was your next kind of steps? You were like, okay, we've got this going. What did you look at next?
Well, so we were ambitious from the start again to build a chain. So that was from the off. So we weren't doing it to do one. So I'd just been bust in Camille, or sorry, in O'Brien's, got completely wiped out. So my thinking is, I need to build this up so I'm going to be able to sell it, and I'll sort out my, you know, I'll get my financial independence back. So that was the kind of the thinking. And so So we were ambitious to try and build a chain of them. So it was kind of, you know, doing much like having babies one at a time, you know, so you don't go from zero to 50 in, you know, like you can in a computer game. So we got to do them actually one at a time to kind of dirt down and dirty. And building a retail chain is really hard in that sense, and particularly when it's food, because each one of them, you know, you've got to get planning permission for, you've got to get a deal done with the landlords, you've got to figure out, you know, the fact that there's no, you know, no gas coming into it, or the drainage is wrong, or the, where you're going to get your ventilation at. So they're really hard actually to build up a chain, because each one of those is a really tough little project in its own in right. So we just started opening one at a time. We had the Dolphins Point, and we did one at Finsborough, and that worked pretty well, and then Rat Mines, and then the Leary, and so yeah, we just did them one at a time, and knowing, as I did from my O'Brien's days, that at some point we'd get kind of momentum, and then it becomes easier in a way, because it's got a life of its own. So you have to force it at the start, and you have to force a chain onto the public, and then it starts building a life of its own, and then it becomes a little easier in one way because it has that life of its own.
How soon did you start marketing the franchise? I know you talked about earlier, I think you're marketing it a year.
Probably after the second or third year, we started marketing the franchise. So we put a little section up on the website. We wouldn't have spent much money on it, but we started kind of putting it out there. We did a few franchise exhibitions when they had them in Ireland. So we started putting ourselves on it. Probably was 3 years after that before we sold the first one.
Okay. So just start again. Just keep going.
Just start again. And, you know, what we're doing in London is exactly the same now. You know, we have 5 restaurants open in London. We got the first franchise away last year. It's one at a time. They're really tough. And, you know, you have to force it. We have to kind of force it at the start a little bit artificially, and we will hit a point, not next year, maybe the year after, where it hits a tipping point, and it kind of takes a life of its own. And so, you know, it's a long game. We're 10 years at this now.
Yeah. You're a big proponent of tech in restaurants, which normally you don't put those two babies together. So how did that come about? Like, what was your vision, or where did that come from?
Well, the very genesis of Camille was that people are addicted to screens, and they're looking for ever more convenience. You know, when I was a kid, you know, convenience was, you know, getting a frozen meal and bringing it home and heating it up. That was convenience. But for the modern generation, that's too much like hard work. I remember at the kind of start of the Camille days, looking at pizza as a really good example. So even now, like a Goodfellas frozen pizza is about £3, right? Same pizza from Domino's is £13. Right. Now, I'd argue most people in the blind taste test wouldn't tell the difference. A good quality products, both of them. So the premium for hot is £10. My God, that's a beautiful thing. That's really beautiful. I really love that. And that was the genesis of it. So somebody paid £10 not to have to take it out of a packet and stick it in the oven. Yeah. That's a beautiful thing. It's really beautiful. So when we were thinking about doing Camille, we were recognizing, first of all, that people are spending ever more time on the screens. And that means, one, they're looking for more convenience. Two, is just spending more time at home. So where you might have gone out 3 nights a week now, you might only go out 2 nights a week because you would prefer to sit at home one of those nights doing your social media or Netflix or whatever it is, and then go out. So if you're at home, you're going to want to be fed. And then the third thing was that, you know, takeaway foods have traditionally not had a great reputation. Mm. So, you know, lowest common denominator, not very high quality, and not very good for you to eat frequently. So when I was a kid, you know, you might have got a takeaway meal once a month. It was after the pub. If it was a Chinese, you were very careful not to spill the curry sauce in your shoes because it would never come out. Right. So, but it was infrequent, and because it was infrequent, you didn't really think about the health risk.
Yeah.
My daughter lives in London now, and she has takeaway foods 3 nights a week.
Mm, wow.
Not once a month. And when I say takeaway, I'm making her sound like she's a bad person, but she's having something like a Camille or a salad, but she's having it prepared outside the home because she's busy. And
I think that's very common. I think that's not a stat that shocks me at all, to be honest.
The cost is really low. So we thought that was going to come as well. We thought that, yeah, people are going to be eating takeaway foods much more, and there's no healthy alternatives. So let's do something healthy. So, and then we saw going with the, you know, people spending all their time on screens, they're interacting with the world through the screen. So we need to get really savvy on having a good app. So we embraced that from the very beginning, having a really good online ordering experience. Then we realized with, you know, the volume of food we do, if you think about a restaurant close to you, Gary, you know, with 50 seats, they might do, on a Saturday night, they might do two covers, which, you know, turn the tables twice. Mm. So they might do 100 covers. Busy Camille might do 1,000 main courses in a night. Wow. Out of the same size premises. So it's a logistics exercise. You need to be really on your game in terms of how you process that order. So we use a lot of software in the business. You know, if you make an order with us, we clock the order when we get it. We clock it when it goes onto the cook line. We clock it off the cook line. We clock it when it goes out the door. We clock it when it gets to your door. And we clock the driver when it comes back again.
Wow.
And we use that to help us manage bottlenecks and to make sure the thing is as efficient as we can be. So we use technology for that as well. We're a launch partner for an Irish startup called Mana, which is a guy called Bobby Healy, and they make drones. And drones are coming. They're coming really soon. And drones are just, we are love the idea of them. So as a business, it's going to be about half the cost of sending a driver.
Wow.
So that's a big thing. For you, Gary, as a consumer of Cameo, you're going to get it in about half the time you normally get it, because the drone takes off, flies to you. There's no traffic, there's no waiting, there's no rain, you know, it comes straight to you. And thirdly, it's totally fits in with our environmental credentials. So, you know, I can send you a 3-ton car to you with that big smelly carbon footprint,
yeah,
or I can send a battery powered drone to you, and there's no difference it's much quicker for you, but it's just incomparably affecting the environment of that electric drone versus sending the smelly car. So we've really embraced that, that it's really cool how it works. So you send us an order, right? The first time you order for a drone delivery from us, we send you back a Google Earth image of your house with a grid overlaid in it.
Okay.
And we ask you to pick a square where you want the food dropped. So if you've got a house with a garden, it might be outside your front door. So we cook the food, load it into the drone. Drone goes up to about 400 feet, flies directly to you at 80 kilometers an hour. When it gets to your house, it sends you a text message where it says, are you ready to receive your order? You say, yeah. Drone comes down to 40 feet. Little door opens at the bottom of the drone. Food drops down on a biodegradable string, very important.
Oh, got that.
Biodegradable string, and it unravels from the drone and falls down on top of the food. And then it goes back up and flies back to base. So the drone doesn't land, it's fully autonomous. It works. They've been testing it in Moneygall in Tipperary.
Seriously, that's very near to my home place in Nina there. So that's good to see.
So they've actually pivoted, and it's the right thing to do. But they pivoted from food to delivering for the HSE prescription.
I saw that, yeah.
And that's been working really well. But the technology works. The big barrier is getting it passed by the Irish Aviation Authority. It has to have the same safety standards as a commercial aircraft. So actually, when the drone takes off from a Camille and flies to your house, it files automatically a flight path with the IAA.
Oh, cool. I was wondering that,
fly into that. So it's not really an issue at the start when there isn't very many drones. But the drones are going to be in cities, they're going to be in their tens of thousands. And so you've got to make sure that they don't crash into each other or cause accidents. So that's the big bit. And, you know, it all works. We're pretty sure that it'll be regulated the early part of next year, and we'll be live with our first few sites at some point next year.
I was going to ask you, when am I getting my chicken mass man by drone? Yeah, that's what I want to know.
But it's so cool. You know, if you think about it for food delivery, it's so perfect. Because most of our deliveries in any community at the moment are within 2 miles of the restaurant.
Okay.
The vast majority are within 2 miles. It's a perfect distance for a drone to deliver.
Yeah.
Ideal payload for these drones is about 2 kg, 2 kilograms, which is basically 2 mass mans and 2 rices.
Perfect.
It's perfect.
Just perfect.
Yeah, just really for those kinds. So it's not going to do away with delivery drivers. It will still be locations where you have to do. But we think it'll take 60-70% of the deliveries we currently do cars off those. Take those cars off the road and reduce the cost for us. Get it quicker to you. Save the planet.
Everyone's a winner. God bless Bobby. What else are you looking at in the tech space? Because I know there's a few things you're kind of looking at.
Yeah, the other one is big thing is robotics. So. One of the last bastions of labor-intensive industries that haven't really been affected by robots is catering, is food service. And it's a business that is very labor-intensive. in most restaurants, you know, it's all manual labor. So we're looking at getting semi-automatic wok cookers where we take maybe half of the process of cooking and automate it, and then we can redeploy those staff into other kind of less mundane jobs, into more interesting jobs. So that is underway. For us, it's potentially going to reduce our labor costs and improve our speed, which means we give a better service to our customers ultimately, because we can deliver quicker. So that's really interesting and really exciting as well. So the robotics, the drones, the app we developed ourselves, we're doing over €1 million euros in sales a month on that at the moment, wow, which is just fantastic. You know, we developed it from scratch ourselves, and it's a really good online ordering experience. You know, it works. It's good. So we put all those things together, and so technology is absolutely at the heart, you know, of making this business successful. We sometimes describe ourselves as a logistics business that happens to sell Thai food, because it's, you know, going through those volume of food we're doing, you know, getting it here, you know, half an hour is like it, you know, if we can't get it to you in half an hour, Gary, you're not going to be so happy.
We've got to be really on the ball. People's patience levels have dropped. Yeah, people want everything immediately.
And our problem, like any food business, is everybody orders at sort of 7:30 and 5:00 at the same time. And no matter what we do, we can't really change that.
You know, do you think there's a time whereby, you know, it could become a dark kitchen, essentially, whereby Camille's are just in a building?
Yeah.
The drones are just literally shooting out every couple of minutes. Is that possible?
We have one in London. We have a cloud. We like to call them cloud kitchens, not dark kitchens. So just think about that, Gary. If you're working in it, do you want to work in a cloud kitchen, which is uplifting?
It does sound beautiful. It does sound like
you want to work in a dark kitchen.
It's all about that branding.
So they were, you know, it's part of the suite of options you have as a business. So we've got one in a place called Bermondsey in London. We're opening another one in Canary Wharf. Canary Wharf is really expensive real estate. And so this is a way for us to get into that market and try it at a very low capital cost, because that's the big thing about them. But operating it, cloud kitchen is basically a kitchen unit. So somebody rents, an operator rents maybe, you know, a 5,000 square foot warehouse, fits it out with 10 different kitchens. We take one of them for Camille. So in the rent, they cover the capital cost of that. There's no, from Camille's point of view, there's no front of house, there's no telephones. So it's just a kitchen. And then we have a fleet of bike riders coming in to take the food and deliver it. So it's very interesting. There's huge growth in it at the moment because of the pandemic. It's a very interesting, we don't think it'll replace, you know, who's serving you in Mahini or wherever it is. We think the high street frontage is really important. You need to see us. We need to be part of your local community. So we think we're never going to do away with high street frontage. But at the same time, there are places where it's efficient to operate. A lot of people ordering online, they don't care if there's a physical restaurant behind it or not. It's not really a huge impact. We started a virtual brand in London called Slam and Ramen. Do you know what a virtual brand is?
Yeah, so it's no physical presence at all. Purely cloud.
It's going gangbusters.
Really?
It's really quick. Yeah.
So is that something you might be spinning off in the future in terms of other brands?
Yeah, well, I don't know spinning off, but it's about sweating the asset in Camille harder.
Okay.
So if we can make the kitchen, that existing capital investment, work harder, then we're going to get a better return overall. That's the basic idea. So we've got Salmon Ramen. We've just launched a lunchtime brand in London called Greens and Shoots, and it's a kind of a salad poke bowl idea, but we're not very busy at lunchtimes in Camille's. Because we tend to be in suburban areas and working in town. This is, you know, prior to the pandemic. So there's not a lot of pressure on our kitchens at lunchtime. So we could do a virtual brand out of the kitchen, which isn't very busy anyway. We're just sweating the asset. Just sweating the asset more. So virtual brands are big. But, you know, at the same time, virtual brands, you know, need investment put into them, same as any brand does. But it's just an interesting way, you know, the whole restaurant model has changed. You know, it used to be, you know, you develop, you know, you've got an expertise in burgers or pizzas or chicken or whatever it was. You never did anything else. Now businesses are looking at, you know, I've got this physical asset of a kitchen. It's available 24 hours a day. I'm probably really only using it for 3 hours a day. So can I do something with the other 21 hours?
We're almost out of time. Just have one final question for you. You kind of touched on earlier that you're a bit of a reader. We also recommend a book at the end of every pod. And then we give it away to someone, whoever just tags you and tag Camille and tag myself in the in promoting the post and the pod.
Yeah.
What book would you recommend people read?
Well, I've loads of books. I mean, I tend to that Lean Startup, I would totally recommend that. For anybody starting a business, the book is really about kind of software startup type companies, but we found it totally applicable for a restaurant business. I tend to read books that are relevant to our industry. So, you know, there's a book called Pizza Tiger about the foundation of Domino's, a brilliant read, an Irish American guy called Tom Munner. Set that up. Anybody starting a business, like, it's just a great yarn, and boy, the tough.
What's that one called?
Pizza Tiger.
Pizza Tiger.
Okay. Pizza Tiger. Great fun. Search of Excellence was, we love that book. I mean, there's so many books.
Nail Your Colors to the Mask. Come on, give us one book that you recommend everyone should read.
Well, I would probably go with the Lean Startup.
Perfect.
Or anybody starting a business of any description, just the principal idea of speed over perfection, and just get your minimum viable product out there early and start getting feedback. Don't wait for perfection, because your perfection might be wrong. So, you know, when I was talking about at the start of the Camille journey with the Chinese, I spent 6 months doing a business plan, and then I opened the business and nobody had a blind bit of interest in pursuing my business. I'd have been better spending a month in the business plan, opening the thing up quicker and finding out quicker what I needed to find out.
Treat it so as a live document.
That's a really, really big lesson. I think speed over perfection to get started, and start as soon as you can, start getting that customer feedback. That Lean Startup by Eric Ries tells you how to do that.
Beautiful. Brody, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, Gary. Good to talk to you, and good luck with the podcast.
Thank you very much. And that was episode 67 with Brody Sweeney. If you want to win the book that Brody talked about, The Lean Startup by Eric Ries, it is a very good book. I've read it a number of years ago. I must get it out and reread it again. If you want to win that book, simply tag Camille Thai and tag me, Mr. Gary Fox, in any of your social channels when sharing this episode, and I will pick one winner to win that book this week. I'll see you next Monday for the Idea Lab.